Although neither the CIA nor FBI had yet heard of al-Qaeda, by 1994, Clinton, Lake, and I believed our response to terrorism should be high on the list of measures to shape the post-Cold War world. Part of that response was developing a new policy on counterterrorism to replace what Reagan had signed 7 years earlier. I drafted and circulated a new policy for approval by all of the relevant departments and agencies, and soon President Clinton signed Presidential Decision Directive 39, U.S. Policy on Counterterrorism. It reiterated the no-concessions policy, which the Reagan administration had violated by trading arms to Iran for the release of American hostages. It called for both offensive and defensive actions in order to reduce terrorist capabilities and in order to reduce vulnerabilities at home and abroad. Law enforcement, intelligence, military, and diplomatic tools would be used and coordinated. Finally, there would be, quote, no greater priority than preventing the acquisition of weapons of mass destruction by terrorists, unquote. Or, if that failed, there would be no greater priority than removing that capability. The new policy sounded good, but it depended on intelligence that remained spotty. The search for the two remaining World Trade Center bombers continued in 1994, with Ramzi Youssef getting the most intensity. Unknown to us at the time, he engaged in unsuccessful plots to kill the Pope and later President Clinton, both in the Philippines. Then in January 1995, Manila police responded to a fire in an apartment building. The message from Manila popped up on my computer screen on a Saturday morning. I printed it and ran from my office in the executive office building across the parking lot, known as West Exec, to the West Wing. I interrupted a meeting Tony Lake was having on Bosnia and announced, "They found Ramzi Youssef." "That's great news," Lake replied. "No, it's not. He got away," I exhaled. "And he was planning to blow up U.S. airliners in the Pacific with bombs smuggled on board, bombs we wouldn't notice, using liquid explosives. They're assembled on board in the bathroom and then left there. The terrorist then gets off at the first stop and the plane continues on and blows up. The Filipinos found some of the bombs, but not all. He had the flights all picked out. United, Northwest, 11 of them. 747s. Lake got the image. U.S.-owned airlines with flights in the Pacific were told to ground them. Flights in the air were turned around. Nothing was found. Ramzi Youssef had again eluded capture. The Counterterrorism Security Group had already decided to issue a reward for Youssef and had authorized the distribution of matchbooks throughout the Middle East and South Asia, noting our $2 million bounty. There was a flood of people claiming to know where he was and seeking the reward. Virtually all of them were worthless leads. In early February, however, one of the callers actually did know. In the early morning hours of the day on which Ramzi Youssef planned to take a bus from Pakistan to Afghanistan, he was rudely awakened by Pakistani and American officers. A few days later, he was back in New York. After his arrest, Ramzi Youssef became a man of as much mystery and attention as when he was at large. With almost every terrorist incident or similar event, an urban legend develops that challenges the official story. With Ramzi Youssef, the legend was that there were actually two people. One was the man arrested by the FBI in Pakistan, and the other was a mastermind of Iraqi intelligence, the Muhabarat. This legend was part of the theories of Laurie Milroy. Milroy's thesis was that there was an elaborate plot by Saddam to attack the United States, and that Youssef was his instrument. Her writing gathered a small cult following, including the recently relieved CIA director Jim Woolsey and Paul Wolfowitz.